Good morning.
Good morning.
Bodhisattvas in winter. We've had wet snow like this before at Loon Lake at times, but more often windy storms, rainstorms. This really feels like winter here. And there's something both vivifying is the word that comes to mind, and comforting at the same time.
Pardon me?
Thank you. I will try and speak up. There's something about snow, and this may be characteristic of those of us who grew up with it, I don't know, that to me is both, the words that come to mind are both vivifying, really, you know, bright and alive, and comforting, holding at the same time. I just made that up. It's another Zen paradox. So good morning. I'm so glad to see you all safely here. We have one more person arriving today, hopefully safely, and then some on Tuesday. Do we have some people out there in the cloud today? Greetings to all of you as well. I have to look that way. I'm orienting to giving a Dharma talk from a height. Feels a little bit strange. Well, I hope you slept well, being a little warmer. As Michael said yesterday, we are at this Rohatsu Sesshin celebrating the Buddha's enlightenment. We also, in a way, the whole Sesshin is a kind of ceremonial reenactment of Buddha's enlightenment, sitting here amongst the tall red cedars. Taigen Layton, who is an American Zen teacher, perhaps underappreciated. He's one of the finest we have. Calls Zazen a ritual, a kind of ceremonial enactment of the Buddha's enlightenment. You might not feel like it, but when you take that seat, you are taking the Buddha's seat. It's not so easy to put in words what enlightenment is, what's the experience of enlightenment, as it's perhaps somewhat misleadingly translated into English. Enlightenment has perhaps misleading associations. And some have proposed that awakening is perhaps the better word to use, but awakening to what? We could say enlightenment itself is a koan. Is it sudden or gradual? Is it something to be achieved after countless lifetimes of practice, or something to awaken to right here and now in this body-mind? These are questions that have been debated almost from the beginning, pretty much from the beginning of this tradition. But rather than reaching for right or wrong or correct answers, I think we'd do better to take up these questions as koans, the koan of enlightenment. Yesterday, Michael told the story of the Buddha's enlightenment, how after tremendous efforts practicing with the major teachers of his day, undergoing extreme ascetic practices, nearly starving, still not having reached the freedom that he was seeking, he finally sat down beneath the Bodhi tree and vowed not to get up until he broke through to deep awakening. It's a heroic story of an extraordinary human being who became one of the greatest spiritual teachers in history. He sat through the night unwavering, facing Mara's hordes, the demons of doubt and temptation. And when the morning star appeared, he saw deeply into the true nature of existence. He realized the Four Noble Truths, the Noble Eightfold Path, and he set out on a long life of teaching. But what if we're not feeling very heroic? Like other heroes in the epics of many cultures, the Buddha still had challenges ahead. Even after enlightenment, his jealous cousin, Devadatta, tried to stir up dissension in the Sangha. He tried to set up a splinter group, very cultish. He even made an assassination attempt on the Buddha. Bad karma. Oh, and now that I've said that, I have to insert a little story that we mentioned a few weeks ago, where Devadatta was sent to some terrible torment in some hell realm, which of course is what one suffers when one, you know, causes a lot of harm in the world. It's a kind of inner torment, I think. So Devadatta is down there suffering in the hell realm, and the Buddha comes and offers him a hand out. It's a beautiful little story. And there were wars in the Buddha's times. There were regional kingdoms, his own, the Shakya kingdom, and the Buddha tried three times to stop a war and failed. The Buddha himself failed to stop a war. And his own people were slaughtered. So here we are, how many centuries later, once again, as humanity failing to stop a devastating war, when the Buddha himself couldn't do it. And yet he went on. He found a way to go on. And his old friend, Mara, the tempter, continued to pop up. These stories exist in the old suttas. Continued to pop up now and then with comments such as, "Wouldn't you be able to do more good if you went into politics?" Or, "Haven't you done enough already? Let the next generation take over." You know, that's what Mara would show up with, and the Buddha. What the Buddha would always say is, "I see you, Mara. I see you. I recognize you." And Mara would kind of dissolve, go away. So the Buddha found a way to continue to live and teach for decades in this world full of human suffering. And it couldn't have been easy, even for a Buddha. How much more so for us, practicing as ordinary people in the 21st century, in a world still fraught with suffering, wars, human cruelty, and injustice. Not to mention collapsing ecosystems. Sickness, old age, and death are still very much with us, despite the headlines that hold out hope that medical technology is very close to vanquishing them all. Not true. And the karmic consequences of human greed, hatred, and delusion are painfully evident to this day. Sometimes I wonder how I could manage to live in this world without the path of the Bodhisattva. Path of the Bodhisattva being an elaboration of Buddha's teachings, which emerged in new texts around the beginning of the Common Era and came to be known as the Mahayana, the Great Wheel. I really love the Bodhisattva way because it allows for the slow, steady courage of ordinary people, learning to pay attention to life as it is, in each moment, opening to wisdom and compassion. The Bodhisattva realizes right in the midst of samsara that this life is not just my life, because it is boundlessly, my little life is boundlessly interconnected with everything else. And at the very same time, this particular life matters. Everything we do or don't do or say or don't say flows onward and outward without limit, beyond what we will ever know or see, for the benefit or detriment of all beings. How about that? Like, we matter. So Zen, the Mahayana school that developed in China with meditation as its foundational practice, emphasizes the non-duality of samsara and nirvana. Awakening manifesting right here, in this moment, in this world. So many of the koans, these ancient teaching stories and dialogues that we've been practicing with, many of them nudge us to wake up to that reality, that non-dual reality. So I'm going to share this morning two koans about enlightenment. Or perhaps I should say non-attainment. You'll see. The first one is one that Michael talked about a few weeks ago. It's case 62 of the Book of Serenity, and it goes like this. Mihu had a monk ask Yangshan, "Do people these days need enlightenment or not?" And Yangshan said, "It's not that there is no enlightenment, but what can be done about falling into the secondary?" The monk went back and reported this to Mihu, who deeply agreed. That's the koan. You can listen to Michael's talk online if you want more background and more in-depth discussion. What I just want to note here is that so often in these old dialogues, the monk is not asking the right question. Do we need enlightenment or not? Or as another translation puts it, do people nowadays depend on enlightenment or not? Well, the question itself depends on what we think enlightenment is. Is it a lightning strike experience of profound awakening to emptiness? Is it a steady state of freedom from delusion and obstruction following such an experience? Is such an experience even necessary? People often wonder, or sometimes come into Dokusan and ask, was that experience I had in childhood, or at my last sesshin, or out of nowhere one day, was that enlightenment? How will I know it when it comes? Is that the only way to be free from suffering? From that nagging dissatisfaction and anxiety that plagues me? But Yangshan refused to answer that question. He put a stop to it. He said, "It's not that there's no enlightenment. Don't grasp for it. But also don't brush it off as just a concept. Instead," he says, "what are you going to do about falling into the secondary?" Falling into the secondary means that state of the relative, our everyday life, the good and the bad, the right and the wrong, life and death, the eight worldly winds that knock us off course, off balance, pleasure and pain, loss and gain, praise and blame, fame and disrepute, where we're trying to avoid one and we really would like more of the other, right? That's falling into the secondary. He says, what are you going to do about that? Because even after one of those big experiences or small experiences of awakening, it's easy to fall into the secondary. Some very accomplished spiritual people have gotten into trouble because they forgot that. So what are we going to do about that? Just cause ourselves and others more trouble? Or are we going to pay attention to notice what's going on in body, heart, and mind, to see deeply into the roots of our suffering, into our conditioning, and with endless patience and kindness, let go, let go, let go. That's the practice of a bodhisattva in this world that opens us to compassion for the suffering of in ourselves and others. A bodhisattva knows, as Dogen tells us over and over, that practice, realization, and actualization are inseparable. No one can manifest without the others. We have to practice, awaken, and actualize, live it. It has been said, I forget by whom, if I ever knew, that there is no awakened person, only a continuously awakening person. So this leads us to the second koan I want to give you for today, and it's from a different collection, not the Book of Serenity that we've been mainly using this practice period, but from the Gateless Gate or Gateless Barrier, the Mumon Khan. And this one goes, a monk asked the priest Qingzheng, the Buddha of supremely pervading, surpassing wisdom, did zazen on the Bodhi seat for 10 kalpas, but the Dharma of the Buddha did not manifest itself, and he could not attain Buddhahood. Why was this? And Qingzheng said, your question is exactly to the point. The monk was not satisfied with that answer and said, but he did zazen on the Bodhi seat. Why couldn't he attain Buddhahood? And Qingzheng answered, because he is a non-attained Buddha. So like most koans, it needs a little bit of unpacking to access. Usually when a Zen teacher talks about a koan, first they give the pedigree of the Zen master who features in the story and who is a disciple of so-and-so, who is a disciple of so-and-so. But I'm going to skip that because you won't remember all those names anyway. It is helpful, though, to know that the Buddha, supremely pervading, surpassing wisdom, that's his name, was a mythic Buddha who appears in Chapter 7 of the Lotus Sutra, in which the Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, tells the story of a deeply devout king who lived an immeasurably long time ago, who sat zazen on the Bodhi seat for 10 kalpas and still did not attain enlightenment. So the Bodhi seat is a translation of the Sanskrit Bodhimanda, which refers to that place beneath the Bodhi tree. And as I said, each time you sit down to practice zazen, you are taking the Bodhi seat. So you can kind of feel your way into that. This is my Bodhi seat, you know, whether it's at home or here, or even sitting on the bus one day when you need to, you can just kind of, I'm going to take my Bodhi seat. I need to right now. So yesterday, Michael explained a little bit about what a kalpa is. But according to my research, a kalpa, well, first you have to imagine immense mountain, 16 miles high and 16 miles wide. So a kalpa is the length of time it would take for that mountain to completely wear down to nothing if a heavenly being flew over it once a year and lightly brushed it with their silken robe. That's how long a kalpa is. So I don't know how those guys figured out it was 1.3 trillion years. So if you start feeling discouraged sitting through Sesshin Week, just think of that old king sitting for 10 kalpas without attaining Buddhahood. So the point of this koan, of course, is to nudge us out of the mistaken belief that enlightenment is something we can get or keep or even attain. Even though that phrase, attain Buddhahood, it's used all the time in Buddhist texts. It's deceptive. Our error is common and understandable. Who among us has not at some point felt or asked our teachers, I've been practicing really hard for a year now, or two, or 10, or 30 years, and I'm not sure if I've had an enlightenment experience. I might have. That one might have been. You know, why? Why am I still not enlightened? So when we feel like that, maybe we go off and there are several possible directions. There must be something wrong with me. You know, I'm just not cut out for this. It's too hard. I'm hopeless. Or I think I'll give ayahuasca a try. That should speed things along. I won't need 10 kapas. Or obviously this teacher isn't enlightened enough to get me where I need to go. Those are the kinds of, when we start bargaining with enlightenment, that's what we do. We start bargaining. So maybe that's how the monk felt when he brought up to his teacher this example of the Buddha supremely pervading, surpassing wisdom. And he clearly wasn't satisfied when the teacher just said, your question is exactly to the point. He didn't get the point. So he asked again, why? Why couldn't he attain Buddhahood? Because he is a non-attained Buddha. What kind of oxymoron is that? So, back to the Lotus Sutra story. The king sat in Zazen for 10 kalpas without attaining Buddhahood. And then, with the help of various gods and heavenly beings, he sat for another 10 more kalpas and was fully awakened. He preached the Four Noble Truths and the 12-fold chain of causation, and then passed into a deep meditative state for another immensely long period of time. He had somewhere along the way 16 sons who had become novice monks, and at that point, all of his sons fanned out across the many lands teaching the Dharma to monks and nuns and lay men and women, even though they were not fully enlightened themselves. And the youngest of those sons, according to this mythic story, became Shakyamuni Buddha. The Lotus Sutra is just full of this kind of hyperbole. It's quite baroque. And I'm sure that, you know, I just bet there were some daughters too that didn't make the cut. You know, didn't get into the literature. That's how it has tended to be for a long while. But the message of the Lotus Sutra, actually, despite all this fantastic imagery, is an egalitarian message, that the Buddha Dharma is accessible to all, not just to great kings, not just to unattained ordinary folks, and that we can all practice and realize the deep truths of existence and walk the path of the Bodhisattva. We studied the Lotus Sutra for practice period some years back, and despite my initial resistance to it, I was really deeply moved by the message that no, it's not out there kalpas and kalpas away, but right here in our ordinary practice that we can awaken. Not that we can keep it and hold it. We have to keep practicing, right? So this koan sets up the central paradox of Zen. We live in the simultaneous truths of the relative, everyday world, this big mess. And at the same time, we live in the absolute, the boundless, no separation, in a kind of dynamic interconnection, where dualities dissolve. In the commentary to this koan by Wuman, his name is No Gate. He says if an ordinary person realizes they are thus a sage, if a sage understands, they are thus an ordinary person. So if an ordinary person like you or me lets the obstacles to clear awareness drop away, even for a very short time, we are then sages. We are a sage. Our Buddha nature manifests. And if a sage enters into the discriminating mind of everyday life, then they're an ordinary person. That one, the sage becoming an ordinary person, can be taken two ways. It can mean even a sage can slip into the secondary, right, into habit patterns of grasping and aversion, self-delusion. It only takes a split second to slip, right? Even a sage. But it can also mean that a sage can function in this world of samsara, fully acquainted with the many kinds of delusions and obstructions, because very aware of their own experience, right? And thus able to use wisdom and compassion and skillful means to meet others and help others to awaken. So a sage can be an ordinary person in that way as well. So we are all both sage and ordinary person. Deluded, yeah, most of the time. And also in any moment of full awareness, we are Buddhas. Hindrances drop away, fear drops away. And so we practice. We practice to be stable and flexible, steady in our aspiration, nimble in our recovery when we stumble. So much of the art of life is the art of repair, right? Woman's commentary reminds me of a passage from the core, really, Soto Zen text by Dogen called Genjo Koan. Many of you know this. I like to translate Genjo Koan as the fundamental koan of life, you know, of self and world. Those who have great realization of delusion are Buddhas. Those who are greatly deluded about realization are sentient beings, ordinary people. So see how he keeps flipping it? In other words, Buddhas see clearly and deeply into the roots of delusion, and ordinary beings have deluded ideas about enlightenment. That's what he's saying. Further, he continues, there are those who continue realizing beyond realization, who are in delusion throughout delusion. There is no end to realization or to delusion. When Buddhas are truly Buddhas, they do not necessarily notice that they are Buddhas. However, they are actualized Buddhas who go on actualizing Buddhas. So in those moments when we are free of obstruction, we're not sitting there patting ourselves on the back, saying what great Buddhas we are. We're fully just there, awake. You might not even know that you were awake, because you already forgot it afterwards, right? But sometimes we do. Sometimes we do feel what that's like. And it can be a little, we don't have to self-congratulate, but it can be a little touchstone. Ah, yeah, that's how it feels to not be afraid. That's how it feels to not feel alone in the world. Ah, touchstone. As with all the koan collections, there's always a verse to amplify the koan, and here is the one by Wu Men. There's some music playing, it just distracted me. It's sort of icy precipitation falling on the skylight. Listen to that. Okay, now I'll read you a woman's verse. Better than knowing the body is to know the mind in peace. When the mind is realized, the body is no longer anxious. When body and mind are fully realized, the saintly hermit declines to become a noble. So our practice is bringing awareness to the totality of body-mind experience and world, right? Because our body and mind are not bounded. So body in this verse is referring, I think, when it says better than knowing the body is knowing the mind in peace, body there is referring to the stuff of our lives, you know, that we think we need and to be alive. What we have and don't have, what we want and don't want. Then he's saying that when the whole body, heart, and mind is at ease, we are no longer anxious. As the Heart Sutra says, we chant that, without hindrance there is no fear. Far beyond all inverted views, one realizes nirvana right in the midst of samsara. Just turns. There's a wonderful anecdote by the 20th century Japanese Zen master Zenkei Shibayama Roshi. Story of an old Japanese hermit who declined to become a noble. His name was Tosui, and he preferred to live in a hut and beg for alms rather than become an abbot of a temple. One day, a devout follower of the Pure Land Buddhist tradition, which is a very devotional practice of chanting the name of Amida Butsu, Namo Amida Butsu, Namo Amida Butsu, whereas Zen, of course, emphasizes Zazen. So the Pure Land person came up to the hut and noticed that Tosui did not even have an image of the Buddha on his little altar. So he came back later with a scroll with a picture of Amida Buddha to give to Tosui and urged Tosui to worship it every morning and evening and recite the name of Amida Buddha. And so Tosui took out a brush and wrote a verse on the scroll. I will let you stay here, Amitabha, but please do not get the impression that I want you to assure my rebirth in the Pure Land. Oh, sorry, I left out the first line. Though my hut is very small, I will let you stay here, Amitabha, but please do not get the impression that I want you to assure my rebirth in the Pure Land. So he declined to become a noble. So this week, as we sit on our Buddha seats, the hours may feel like 10 long kalpas. But whenever hindrances drop away, like the husk of a cicada or an outgrown skin of a snake, we too are unattained Buddhas. We are in the company, we're in good company of unattained Buddhas who declined to become a noble. So I don't know what the best question is to ask about enlightenment. How would you ask it? Maybe the best way to ask is without words and to listen for a wordless reply. So I'll stop talking and we can go back to sitting. Thank you for listening, everyone.